This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
The Arbutus Corridor is an 11-kilometer stretch of land, running from Falls Creek in the north to the Fraser River in the south. Most of the land was part of a 6,000-acre grant to the Canadian Pacific Railway in 1886, when the company agreed to locate the terminus of its national railway in Vancouver, rather than Port Moody. In 1999, the CPR announced its intention to stop using the rail line and sell the land, and they asked the city to rezone it for commercial development. When the city refused, the CPR took them to court. Last month, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that the city does have jurisdiction over land use in the corridor. Dr. Carol Christopher is a board member with SPEC, the Society Promoting Environmental Conservation. She joins me in the studio this morning to tell us more about this issue. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning.
This decision follows a ruling against the city in BC Supreme Court, which followed a reversal in the BC Court of Appeal, which was in favor of the city. Is this recent decision by the Supreme Court significantly different than the original appeal court decision?
I wouldn't say that it's really significantly different. It basically does affirm what the appellate court said. But where it went a little further was to say that the city didn't need to compensate CPR for any what's called opportunity costs. Had CPR been able to develop that corridor with residential housing, it would be assessed at a great deal higher value than as a transportation corridor. So the difference between that, say, roughly $10 to $12 million is what people estimate is the approximate value as a transportation corridor versus possibly as much as $100 or $120 million for a residential development. That's quite a big difference. So the city is not required to in any way compensate CP for that differential cost or that potential loss as an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And why did the CPR want the city to rezone the land?
They wanted to develop it as housing. CPR doesn't want to do the development. They want to sell the land to a development company. But they there's a certain procedure that's prescribed by the federal government, which we could talk about if you want to, that lays out what they must do in order to properly discontinue the use of the rail line. So they were actually asking the city to say, well, we don't any longer want any to pick up an option to use the corridor. We'll allow you to sell it to a developer to be developed as housing. And the city said, no, it's been a transportation corridor for 100 years, and we're going to continue to zone it as a transportation corridor.
And the city didn't want to rezone it because they didn't want it to be anything different than that?
Yeah, well, I can't speak either for the past or the present council, but at the very least I can say that they chose at that point not to rezone it and to hold it as a transportation corridor. And they went a step further. They created an official development plan that called for rail transportation of some sort, for bikeways, for pedestrian paths, and for what they called nature walks, which I would say SPEC hopes would include the gardening along the corridor, because that's quite historic. The Victory Gardens in Carisdale, for example, are 60 years old, more, 65 maybe. And all the gardens along the Arbutus corridor that run between Maple and Cypress, and actually between Arbutus and Burrard Street now, they're like 25 years old. So they're historic natural spaces on the corridor.
And so under the city's plan, this is what the land would be allowed to be used for. It would be limited to things like gardening and bike transportation.
Under the current development plan, yes. Now, no one knows exactly what might happen in the future. So what we do know is that the Supreme Court has agreed that the city has the authority to designate the zoning. If the city now decides that they want to go ahead with that, they can buy the land from CP. The land is still privately owned by the railroad. The city can buy the land from CP, and they can then follow their own development plan, or they could rezone in in accordance with some other visioning that the city may have for it.
And can CP sell the land, or would they sell the land to anyone but the city?
Well, there is a procedure, as I mentioned before. They first have to try to, if there were a railroad company around, they could try to sell it to another railroad, because they could then pick it up and use it in the same way that CP did. Secondly, they have to deal with the municipal government, and the city of Vancouver has the next option, and they hopefully will pick that option up. And only if the city, this is how I understand it, there may be technicalities that could be a little nuanced differently, but basically, if the city, only if the city decides that they're not going to use it, is it then available to be purchased by a third party. And those are provisions of the federal government. That's a procedure of how to discontinue the use of a railroad, because this was land essentially given to the CP in return for building the rail line.
But the city hasn't made clear its intentions whether it's going to buy the land or not.
No. There are some informal comments that are made by various people here and there, but it's hard to put those together into a real clear sense that the city will. You must remember the time at which this development plan was written was before the decision was made to put the RAB line, or now the Canada line, down the Cambie corridor. And so there was a lot of discussion about whether it should go down the Cambie corridor or the Arbutus corridor without incurring the wrath of people who live along Cambie Street. I personally think the decision about where such a line, if you're going to build such a line, should go is probably in the right place just because of population. But the Arbutus corridor is still potentially a good corridor for a rail, some kind of rail service, hopefully neighborhood-friendly rail service at some point in the future.
Do you have any concerns that the city might buy it and then turn around and rezone it, which they could, for commercial or development?
I don't really know what to say about that. You know, I think that there's nothing certain. One thing I think is important to realize that even though the court decision now seems to affirm the city's authority in zoning, I don't think that we can be certain what this or any future council might do with the land.
The CPR has concluded a series of workshops mm-hmm. in neighborhoods along the corridor in Kitsilano, Carisdale, Shaughnessy, mm-hmm. and you did attend several of these.
I attended three out of the four, yeah.
And when you were there, what were the people, what were they asking people about?
Well, they had a very interesting process called co-design that actually engaged people that have developed this process. And they asked people to vision or imagine over a 24-hour period at different intervals starting at 6 o'clock in the morning what might be happening on the corridor. And in different neighborhoods, people were thinking more or less about their own neighborhoods, but there was a lot of people that were thinking about a streetcar. They were thinking about biking. They were thinking about walking their dogs. They were thinking about gardening. There were perhaps one or possibly two people at each of the meetings, but usually only one, who raised the issue of the possibility there would be some kind of residential development. But it was present. So what I would say is that it was very interesting and I think a legitimate process that really did ascertain what the people in the community want. And what they overwhelmingly want is they want it to be retained as a greenway transportation corridor. And different communities had slightly different nuance on whether they wanted more greenway, and others were more enthusiastic about a streetcar. But that was the kind of use that they wanted to see was pretty much in accord with the way the city has written the official development plan.
What is the CPR? What do you think the CPR is hoping to get from these workshops?
Well, I think what they would like to do, and I don't fault them for doing this, is I think they want to create a context in which people from the public can come together and express their views, and that out of that they can bring something to City Council that will help to enhance their perception of the value of the land, because it's the most likely purchaser of the land is the city of Vancouver. And if nobody does anything, it's a pretty bleak-looking railroad that's overgrown with blackberries. If you go out and you engage in a community process and you come back and say, here's a vision that reflects the views of X number of people in different sectors of along the corridor. And I should just say, these are not the only people that are interested in what happens on the Arbutus Corridor. I would have wished it had been a more citywide process, but that's an aside. If you bring that kind of co-design product to City Hall, it has real potential for shaping their perception of the value of the corridor.
And so do you think the CPR was happy with the response they got?
Well, I don't know, and I wouldn't want to speak for them for sure. I think that they are happy to have a good, a respected community process that will bring something that they can point to. But I'm not so sure that they were really ecstatic about the fact that this didn't really, within the community, shift from the idea of a greenway transportation corridor to people seeing it as densely populated with housing. I think they might have liked that better, but I can't speak for them.
Yeah. And SPEC also engaged people in the design process for the corridor. What did you do?
About a year ago, we actually had an opening at Emily Carr in the atrium there, where we displayed 75 submissions from the public. We asked people to, in a sense, do the same thing, but instead of conducting workshops, we just took from anybody that wanted to participate and asked them to write a paragraph, if that's what they felt they could do, to all the way to we got some very elaborate plans that were constructed by architects. And our results were quite similar to the CP results. There were a couple of people that spoke about housing, but the overwhelming majority wanted a transportation greenway corridor with gardens. There were also some very unique suggestions that were made that were quite happily received, and when we displayed them, they were kind of show winners. But in terms of just an overall look at the submissions and what they gave to us, it pretty much confirms what people have said over more than a decade of being polled on what they'd like to happen along the corridor.
And is there any way people can still participate in this?
Well, I'm sure that just as the city is going to, CP has their process and the city is going to have their process, the non-governmental organizations that have been involved are probably going to continue to talk together about what's our next step. No next step has been clearly identified, aside from the fact that we'll continue to work, excuse me, to be sure that the Arbutus Corridor is retained for future transportation purposes and for greenway purposes. And whether or not at some point there is also some further development of housing at certain points along it, I think we all have to wait and see and decide about the appropriateness of that as plans begin to be developed.
And can people go anywhere to see the submissions and the ideas of others?
Yes, as a matter of fact, on the SPEC website, that's www.spec.bc.ca. If you go there, and then along the left-hand side, there's a little button that says Arbutus Corridor. And if you click on that, it'll give you quite a bit of history about the corridor, and it'll also show you the submissions that we had for that contest. And you can see in details, particularly the winning submissions are put in a great deal of detail.
Well, thank you for speaking with me today,
Carol.
Oh, you're
very welcome. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Dr. Carol Christopher. She's on the board of directors of SPEC. And if you want to find more about the design contest for the corridor or anything else about Arbutus Corridor or SPEC, you can find a link on our website, which is cooperadio.org/redeye. This is Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. The history of Vancouver is the subject of two sets of panoramic pictures by photographers Sven-Erik Eriksson and Henry Robideau. The show, Vancouver Panoramas, is now on view at the Tech Gallery at the SFU downtown campus. Laura Lamb saw the show, and she's here with her thoughts. Hi, Laura.
Good morning.
What do you see when you first enter the gallery?
Well, on one wall, you see photographs, panoramas, of Hastings Street. These were taken in 1972, I believe, and they show the whole streetscape, the storefronts on both sides of the street, from, I believe, Abbott to Main. So the effect is that you see something that you could never see in real life, which is every storefront at the same time, all lined up. They look very, very orderly, and it's also another striking thing about it is they look very quiet. It's a very, very still pictures. On the opposite wall, you see panoramas of demonstrations, big demonstrations that happened in the 1980s, the mid-1980s in Vancouver, and these are by Henry Robideau. And they're also panoramas, but they're quite different in look because whereas the ones on the other side, apparently, they were taken in 1972, but they were put together in Photoshop just recently. So they're very seamless looking, whereas the seams in Robideau's are very obvious because what he's done is he's taken pictures with a regular camera and you know, pivoted around to make a panorama out of many pictures, and then he's cut them so that they fit together. And of course, they don't fit together in a seamless way. So he very carefully cut them on different angles so that you get this effect of a panorama. But if you look at them closely, you can see the seams. And on the bottom of these things, which I guess are about, each one would be about maybe 5 foot long and 2 feet high, perhaps. He's written in pen the titles, which are quite extensive. For instance, a title on one of them is Giant Blockade of Organized Labor and the Building Trades on Anti-Union Contractor Kirchhoff's Falls Creek Construction Site, March 12, 1984. And another one, it's a giant crowd of 50,000 people marched to show their disgust for the Socred government's mass firing of 5,000 teachers and government workers, elimination of human rights code, grants to legal aid, dismantling, etc., etc. It goes on. I didn't write it all down. My hand got tired. I think 5 or 6 panoramas of these mass protests. And the effect is really to show how huge these gatherings of people were.
So let's talk about his wall. Why do you think all the caption of these pictures, protests, begin with the word giant, given that usually it's not something that you would describe a gathering of people with?
Yeah. It relates to Robideau's long-term project over a few decades, which is to document giant things. He had this book published called Coast to Coast, Canada's Gigantic, or something, Pacific to Atlantic, of course, Canada's Gigantic. And he's been on this project called Giganthropology. So, for instance, those pictures are all the giant tourist attractions that people put up on the side of the roads, like a giant Pisanki eggs, giant Canada geese, everything to giant milk cartons, giant lumberjacks, giant nickels. So that's his interest, and that's where these are coming from.
Giant roadside objects seem very different from, you know, huge gatherings of people about issues. How can an enormous, you know, enormous nickel or an enormous Ukrainian egg and a gathering of people or a protest be part of the same artistic project?
Well, it may be strange at first to think of demonstrations as cultural objects, but in a sense they are. And both the demonstrations and these giant roadside attractions are kind of grassroots expressions, people's cultural expressions, which use scale in order to have impact. So there is, I think, a connection and a reason why they could be called, the demonstrations could be called giant.
Are they also viewed as or shown as in bad taste or overly cute, like some of these giant roadside objects are?
That's an interesting problem, I guess, because when in photographing these roadside attractions, they do, in Robidoux's photographs, and I'm referring to work that isn't up at the gallery, but I think it's relevant. They're taken with a wide-angle lens, and that makes them look kind of distant and alone and kind of odd. So there's this ironic distance from them, which goes along with this idea that they're kitsch, really. But I think there is a connection, because in both types of cultural objects, demonstrations and giant roadside attractions, there's a kind of a pathos in how the reach of the people who made these things, whether they were an event that happens over time or a giant object, kind of exceeds their grasp. And that's part of the reason we love them, I think. So there could be a relationship there.
Is Robidoux taking the same kind of ironic distance with these protest panoramas?
Well, not so much, because the photographer, Robidoux, was right in the crowd. There isn't that sense that he was far away and looking from a distance. And if there is any irony left, it's undercut by the text, which clearly states his sympathies for the demonstrations. For instance, one of them, which shows the huge crowd that went past the Hotel Vancouver in 1984, or I'm not sure what year it was, 83, I think, where the Socreds were having their convention, and he describes the people who are standing on the sidewalk watching them: fluffy sweater, hip capitalist, flat top entrepreneur, Socred convention candidates being confronted, etc., etc. So there's no doubt where his sympathies lie.
Turning now to the pictures on the other wall, the panoramic streetscape of Hastings by Sven Erik Eriksson. How do these two works inform each other? Is there a relationship between them besides being panoramas?
Well, the first thing that you notice is a real contrast in that Robidoux's are full of people. They're an overabundance of humanity. And the Hastings Street photographs are completely empty, because he took them very early on a Sunday morning when there were no people there. And the purpose of them was to be a background for an animation. So they have this sense of absence of people. Both, though, are just absolutely packed full of interesting facts. For me, as a Vancouverite, I can say for both of them, oh, I was there. I see, you know, that's the way it was. You can even look in the demonstration to see if you see any of your friends, because there's a lot of people there, and if you look carefully, you might see one, or even yourself. And for the Hastings one also, 1972 is when I came to Vancouver, and I compare Hastings Street then as it is now, and felt a little bit of nostalgia for all these things that I remember that the photograph reminds me of. And both of them, you know, are just chock full of facts, and those facts tell a lot and make them really interesting.
What did the facts tell you?
Well, the facts told me something that was very different from one thing that was written on the wall that really bothered me. It said, quote, "The downtown east side has long been associated with crime and underworld activity. That was as true in the 1970s as it is today." And that, I thought that was idiotic. That's not what was there. Why bring in that stereotype of central Vancouver? You know, what I saw in this panorama of Hastings Street is a city that was changing, a city center, which is what Hastings used to be, which was deteriorating, which had been abandoned and was fading. But, you know, and that was part of a planned planned development strategy to move the downtown Vancouver to the west and let the east part of downtown Vancouver fade. But in these photographs, you can see how vital it still was. You know, all the activity, all the shops, all the things that go on in a city center. And You see that Hastings was a kind of organic grassroots cultural expression, what a street should be, or what writers like Jane Jacobs have said that cities should be, and that it's similar to Rovedo's cultural objects, I think, you know, in the demonstration as well.
How is this kind of factual documentary photography valuable?
Well, that brings me to another thing that was written on the wall that kind of dismayed me. The first quote was by the curator of the show, but Rovedo had a little artist statement written on the wall, and he said that his photographs were, quote, created in the spirit of what was known as, quote, documentary photography, which he goes on to say was killed by mass media technology. And I thought that that statement came off like an apology, that he was saying, sorry, I'm still taking these old-fashioned kind of photographs. I just, you know, kind of can't help it. And I wanted to say, Henry, don't apologize. Stand up for your values. Stand up for what you're doing, because it's important. And the same could be said for the photographs on the other side of the wall. They're important historical documents full of information that's worth looking at.
Well, thanks for talking about it with me today.
Well, thank you.
I've been talking to Laura Lam about Vancouver Panoramas on view at the Tech Gallery until April 28th. The Tech Gallery is at 515 West Hastings in the Simon Fraser downtown campus.